Hello, my name is Ted Burns, Senior Director of RADPAC and Political Education for the American College of Radiology, and we are starting a podcast series organized in collaboration with the ACR Centennial Committee as part of the Centennial Celebration. And we're doing a three-part series that's going to look at the past, the present, and the future as it pertains to the ACR's work in government relations on policy issues impacting the radiology profession. With us today are Dr. Bill Thorwer, CEO of the ACR, along with Rebecca Spangler and Ashley Walton, two of our lobbyists from our government relations office. And so we'll just jump right into this. Particular series is going to be the quote-unquote present day, but the present day is really going to cover a time window, I would say, of between, I don't know, let's say 2010-ish to current day. So past, present, but it's present. And so, Dr. Thorwer, I'd like to start with you if I could. And these two things are kind of the perfect representation of DC and policy because it's acronym soup. But I want to kind of have you give us some background on the ACR's involvement with two policies important to the college and the profession, PAMA, and then the MPPR. If you're willing to do so, that would be great background, I think, for our listeners.
Thanks very much, Ted, and it's a pleasure to join you in this discussion and highlight the work that the government relations group has done in conjunction with other portions of the college and the impact that it's had on our members. So I'm actually going to do them in reverse order just so they're kind of temporally accurate relative to the legislative activities. So let me start with the MPPR. That stands for the Multiple Procedure Payment Reduction, and this was something that was implemented by Medicare without legislative action, but by Medicare alone. And fundamentally, they used a provision that's used in surgical procedures, where when a surgeon does an operation, if they open the abdomen and do several things while they're in there, they had a reduction in how much the surgeon is reimbursed because there's only one surgical incision to close and one set of post-operative visits to perform. So that was a longstanding policy by CMS. They mistakenly believed that the same thing applied to radiology. So if a patient had multiple radiology studies performed on the same day, particularly when it was done by the same radiologist, but even if it was done by two radiologists in the same practice, they decided to implement a 25% reduction in what the radiologist was paid for the second, third, and potentially fourth procedure. And again, this was completely an error because obviously if someone has a head CT in the morning and a gallbladder ultrasound in the afternoon, they have nothing to do with each other, and there's really no efficiency as there was in, say, the surgical case I described. So in 2012, they implemented this policy. We went quickly to work to try to explain to Medicare why this was inaccurate. They, quite frankly, didn't listen. So in 2014, as part of the PAMA legislation, and we'll talk about PAMA in more detail in a minute, but as part of that legislation, we got the language inserted that required Medicare to demonstrate the data that they used to implement the MPPR, which was in fact implemented in the PAMA legislation. Well, CMS never responded to that mandate. And in fact, then the next year, we were able to go to Congress. And in December of 2015, we actually got legislated a reversal of that so that the multiple procedure payment reduction was reduced from 25%, which was CMS's implementation, to 5%. And this made a huge difference with all of the radiologists listening know the number of times you do several studies on the same patient on the same day. To give you an estimate on the kind of back of the envelope calculation and actually some work that was done by our Health Policy Institute, this actually calculated to about $2,500 a year in reclaimed reimbursement for radiologists around the country. So really just a tremendous example of the government relations activity yielding results that really served our members well. And again, that's forever. That wasn't just that one year. This obviously is ongoing, and it's in statute, so it's not something that CMS could go reverse. So let me go to the second example you cited, and that is the PAMA legislation. The most important part of that relative to what I'm going to describe is the use of appropriateness criteria that the college began actually to develop in 1993, believe it or not, 30 years ago. The appropriateness criteria were thought to be an answer to multiple reductions in reimbursement for radiology because of a perceived rapid growth in radiology services. And our then chair, Dr. K.K. Wallace went forward and testified before a congressional committee and said that the college would develop criteria and guidance so that physicians or other referrers could, in fact, pick the best test for the patient's clinical circumstance. Well, fast forward, we put together multiple multi-specialty panels to develop these criteria, and this is still ongoing. They're updated every year. We use the RAND scoring method in order to provide that information. Initially, it was on paper, and then subsequently became digital, and then finally was actually made into a point-of-care clinical decision support mechanism so a referrer could actually get this information as they're seeing the patient, get the recommendations of what, if any, imaging would be appropriate. So again, the PAMA legislation in 2014 mandated that those appropriateness criteria be consulted by a referrer who was ordering advanced diagnostic imaging studies, meaning CT, MRI, nuclear medicine, or PET scanning on a Medicare beneficiary. And this was supposed to be implemented January 1st of 2017. CMS tried, and we respect their efforts, but there was a real challenge in the language of the law that required a real-time contemporaneous assessment of whether that consultation of the appropriateness criteria had occurred. And despite years of effort, they were unable to do that. And final rule last year in 2023 indicated that they were pausing their attempt to implement this. We actually began to work with them knowing the challenges CMS was having. The ACR government relations folks were working both with CMS, but also with Congress to correct the very prescriptive language of the PAMA legislation and in replacement of the contemporaneous real-time recording of that consultation, made it an attestation by the referrer that they had done, in fact, done that. And that really will take the load off of CMS and allow them to implement it with new revised language. And this is what's currently on the plate for us to try to get into congressional action this year. We're very pleased to say that CMS did mention in their final rule last year that they recognize the value of appropriate use criteria consultation. They estimated that it would save Medicare approximately $700 million a year if this were to be implemented. And in fact, we had a separate independent assessment of that by the Moran Corporation, which estimated about a $2 billion a year savings over 10 years to Medicare as well. So we think that we have a very strong argument. It obviously is safer for patients. It's much better care. It's more appropriate use of imaging services. And I think everybody wins across the board as well as providing these potential savings. So in a capsule, I think that we have a very good chance, we hope, of getting that corrected this year and going ahead with what were then MPP or what were then the PAMA mandated requirement for that consultation. So again, a quick capsule, and hopefully that gives our listeners some idea of those two, I think, really major legislative efforts that the college has gone through.
I feel like the one constant theme that will probably continuously repeat throughout this is that some of the things that we're working on, it's not like you work on it 1 year and then it's done. It may take 2, 3, 10 years for a variety of different reasons, all have their nuance and dynamic that makes that the case. But it is a theme that we will see as we talk about some other issues. And probably the next issue that kind of falls along that, maybe not as much as ones we'll talk about later, but Rebecca, I know that you, in your time with the college, I don't quite know how long it's been. How long have you been with the college?
14 of the best years of your life, Ted Burns.
14. I've been here 20, and the last 14 have been remarkable. And I know in working with you over those years, you've taken a real interest in kind of taking to the screening efforts that we care so much about here at the college, whether it's MAMO, whether it's CTC, lung cancer, whatever it may be, and then working with USPSTF and some of those things. I don't know if you want to talk about some of our efforts in that area.
Sure. And actually, that was a really good segue as far as kind of having to work on things for an extended period of time to ultimately achieve the success, both on behalf of our members and the patients they serve, right? Especially when you're talking about, you know, population health and screening services. With mammography, I think I'll go ahead and start with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, which was in 2009. The Affordable Care Act greatly expanded coverage of preventative services in the private market and to a certain extent in the public payer world as well. How it did that was basically saying any preventive service that received a grade of an A or a B from the United States Preventive Services Task Force had to be covered with no copay to the patient. At the same time, in 2009, the USPSTF, with their kind of recently elevated role, had updated their recommendations on screening mammography. The college and many others in the women's health and kind of cancer space have remained steadfast that screening mammography should begin annually starting at age 40. The task force wanted to change their recommendation at the time, again in 2009, to biennial beginning at age 50. So we went from annual at 40 to every 2 years starting at age 50. I think it's safe to say on this podcast that we believe that the evidence that they cited to make that determination was scant at the very best. So we immediately went to work with Congress, and we were able to include language in the Affordable Care Act that essentially nullified those 2009 recommendations and ensured that for purposes of coverage, the 2002 recommendations were to be considered most current. So women were still able to talk with their doctor and make the decision that was right for them, again, based on consultation with their physician. And if they chose to continue to start or to continue mammography screening annually beginning at 40, they would not be susceptible to copays. Because we know, especially in the screening world, you know, that there can be many small things that can disincentivize screening. And that lack of a copay is a big factor for a lot of women, especially if you look at those, for instance, with Medicaid coverage. So we were able, again, to kind of congressionally nullify those 2009 screening recommendations. We have managed to do so every basically 1 to 2 years since 2009. The task force, I believe, in around 2016, doubled down on their recommendations. Again, their recommendations at this point are not necessarily considered, in the mammography space, their recommendations are not necessarily considered relevant for coverage purposes because the legislative language, again, reverts back to the annual at 40. So 2016, the task force doubled down on the biennial at 40. Again, we made sure that this didn't actually have an impact on coverage. In 2023, the USPSTF revised their recommendation to biennial screening beginning at age 40. And we were definitely pleased to see that they have acknowledged the need for screening starting at the age of 40. But again, every 2 years is still, we think, insufficient. We have, again, remained steadfast at annual beginning at 40. And as such, we have consistently pushed for legislative language to ensure that those women who choose to do so are able to get their mammogram beginning at age 40 with no cost to the patient. So that's kind of the breast cancer screening situation. The college has also been very involved in low-dose CT screening for lung cancer. We were pleased that that was covered as a Medicare benefit, I believe, starting around 2014, 2015 for Medicare beneficiaries with a certain pack year smoking history. And then the third screening topic that we are definitely very involved in that is another long-term effort is coverage of virtual colonoscopy or CT colonography as a method of colon cancer screening for Medicare beneficiaries. It is a minimally invasive colon cancer screening procedure. You don't have to go, you don't require the anesthesia that you would with an optical colonoscopy. It is covered by many of the private payers in this country, but unfortunately not yet for Medicare beneficiaries. So we continue to kind of push and use every single lever at our disposal to ensure that, you know, Medicare beneficiaries can get that test should they so choose, especially given kind of the rising incidence also in colon cancer in this country.
And I think with the CTC, we've had bills introduced, I feel like, almost every Congress.
Correct.
With a couple of the same sponsors every year who have been very passionate about this issue that I know you've worked very closely with their offices. I think, Danny Davis is one of them, maybe? Or
right, that's correct. We work both the legislative and the regulatory angle simultaneously on this issue.
Great. So I think that's, you know, it's really good to see kind of the whole spectrum of all the different issues that we're dealing with. And I think another one that, and I think to your point, Rebecca, as far as legislative and regulatory and working the different angles, kind of brings up the issue of surprise billing and the No Surprise Act. And that's kind of one that I know, Ashley, you're very knee deep in or up to your neck or however you want to describe it. over the last several years. You want to talk a little bit about what we've done at the college on that front?
Yeah, thanks, Ted. I think it does really speak to the theme of some of the issues we work on are not just a one and done effort. They are a multi-year effort. So the No Surprises Act, or the NSA, was passed back in 2020 as part of the Consolidated Appropriations Act. So this was a multi-year effort by not just the ACR, but many different medical specialties to ensure that patients are protected from surprise medical bills. Now, we thought the ultimate legislation was a great balance between providers and insurers and really did provide a method for disputes to be resolved through an independent dispute resolution process, or the IDR process. So we were really pleased with how the legislation turned out. It was a great compromise with the community. Fast forward to the regulatory process, we've seen the agencies implement the legislation through several different rounds of rulemaking, and that's where things have gotten a little problematic. The ACR has had to join a few different lawsuits. As a friend of the court, along with our colleagues from the American Society of Anesthesiologists and the American College of Emergency Physicians, along with the Texas Medical Association. So these lawsuits are ongoing. We've seen some decisions come down in favor of the community. One of the big issues with that IDR process was really how the payment disputes were being handled in terms of looking at the different factors and how payments should be decided, something known as a qualified payment amount, or the QPA. So that is one big issue that was brought to the court, has favorably come down, on the side of the medical community, but other lawsuits are still outstanding. And some of these other issues that have been brought to the courts are around the IDR fees. We've seen the fees start at $50. This was part of, the first round of regulations. Then we saw, without notice, a huge hike up to $350. And then we've seen additional rulemaking since then as the agencies have worked to respond to the court decision. A proposed rule came out putting it at $150. The medical community said that's still not good enough. So they did work to revise that. And that final rule that we see now, the IDR administrative fee is $115. So you'll see how this is constantly in flux. But, we do feel like the needle has moved. We're being heard. Even though we did have to go to court, at least the regulations as they are being amended are at least on the side of the medical community. Some other issues as it relates to the IDR process that we've seen specific for radiology is just even accessing, that process. It's not just the fee, but it's the rules governing how you enter IDR and how you batch claims and put them together to go through the dispute resolution process. It's really prohibitive to even go through all the effort, pay the fees when, your average claim is only $50. So that's another rule that the agencies are working out right now. We've seen a proposed rule. They're calling it the IDR operations rule, and it's addressing several different things with the fees as well as how batching requirements are being handled. So we're looking forward to seeing that final rule. But again, all these things are a step forward. And, like I said, this legislation was passed in 2020, and we are still seeing everything, unfold through regulatory process and the lawsuit. So I'm going to stop there, but, that's where we are. It's encouraging. We've continued to work with Congress, and Congress is on our side. It's just trying to get these regulations right so that it's workable for physicians. But patients have seen the benefits. So that's what we intended when this legislation was passed. And so that's great to see.
So the light at the end of the tunnel is not a train. It's actually like daylight, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So I think the thing that's interesting too is how some of these are very radiology specific. Some of these are very broad issues that really have impact to beyond radiology. And so, one thing that we haven't really talked about in preparation for this call, but I think it's just something that came to my mind, is how and when we decide to do coalitions, the impact coalitions have. And I know that kind of tees us up for the issue we're going to talk about for Medicare cuts. So maybe you guys can talk about that when you're talking about the Medicare cuts. Yet another issue that will never, ever, ever go away. We joke it's like death taxes and Medicare cuts. But so if any of you wanted to kind of jump in and talk about our never-ending fight on Medicare cuts, kind of what we've been trying to do over the last several years and how the process has worked. That would be, I think, really helpful for our listeners.
Sure. That's usually my cue, so I will take it. In 2019, CMS finalized for implementation in 2021 a major revaluation of the outpatient E&M codes. That revaluation was going to have a significant impact on the Medicare physician fee schedule because CMS is statutorily required to apply what we refer to as budget neutrality inside of the fee schedule. So essentially, for something to go up, other things must come down. Unfortunately, because of that, because of just kind of the nature of the practice, those who build a high amount of outpatient E&M codes, so essentially primary care, neurology, and others, were slated to see a pretty significant increase. And those of us who bill little, if no E&M, were slated for a pretty significant decrease. Simultaneously, CMS also wanted to implement a CMS-generated add-on code for complex care, which was meant to be billed in addition with E&M codes. They kind of further increased the bump to primary care, but then unfortunately further decreased the bump to those of us who don't bill E&M. So the proposed reduction to the conversion factor for calendar year 2021, we were looking at roughly a 10% reduction. Now, that is a significant reduction. The typical conversion factor reduction prior to this outpatient reevaluation was about in the 1% to 2% range. So going from 1% to 2% to 10% was obviously a pretty big dip. The, I don't want to say wild card, I don't think we're past it enough to call it a wild card, but then COVID happened. And COVID happening in March of 2020 obviously already stressed or further stressed an already stressed healthcare delivery system. So we really knew that we had to do whatever we could to turn to Congress to try to get relief to some of these payment reductions on behalf of our members who were doing their absolute best at the time to just make sure that they were keeping people alive. So what we started looking at is that, you know, I started by looking at CMS publishes what is an impact table. So they essentially will tell you who is the most impacted by specialty. And you have to remember that it's non-physician providers that bill off the Medicare physician fee schedule as well. So everybody knows there's, you know, the specialists ourselves, anesthesiologists, others, but people tend to forget that you have, you know, physical therapists, occupational therapists, social workers to a certain extent that also bill off the Medicare physician fee schedule. So ACR was able to form a pretty large coalition of those of us who bill, again, very little, if no E&M. So you have the non-physician providers, radiology, pathology, a lot of the surgical specialties were involved. And we were able to work together to lobby Congress to, you know, basically ask them to please help us because a 10% reduction is never sustainable. It was most certainly not sustainable starting on January 1st, 2021, given the state of the world. Congress responded by adding 3.75% to the conversion factor for 2021. And then they also postponed implementation of that G code for 3 years. So that G code was postponed until January 1 of 2024. So the overall conversion factor reduction went from a minus 10 to approximately a minus 4, give or take a quarter of a percent there. And Ted, to your coalition's question, it was a great experience being able to work with both our physician and non-physician provider friends. We can't agree on all the things all the time, but it absolutely makes good sense to work together on the things that we do agree on. And we were unfortunately all in the same really terrible boat with this payment policy. And we have continued to work together since then to kind of help Congress or help urge Congress and push Congress to both provide short-term relief to the physicians as far as conversion factor and overall payment reductions are concerned, but also to make the point that these year-over-year reductions are really not sustainable. And it is having a real-world impact on providers and how they practice. And then, unfortunately, that impact negatively impacts patient access to care. So Congress has added additional percentage to the conversion factor for 2022, 2023, and 2024. What happened at the end of 2023 is that unfortunately, I think broader political issues kind of intervened and Congress did not add anything further to the conversion factor for 2024. Now, just kind of a little asterisk there, they did add 1.25 for calendar year 2023, but we were, I'm sorry, they did add 1.25 for calendar year 2024 in 2022. Now, that being said, with the new G code coming online in 2024, the conversion factor reduction was still minus 3.37%, which we acknowledge is definitely not 10, but it is still not nothing. So broader political issues, I think, prohibited Congress from adding anything additional to the conversion factor for 2024. But the coalition continues to work together and continues to urge Congress to, again, you know, give the providers some kind of short-term relief while we work together on long-term reform to ensure that, you know, Medicare beneficiaries have access to a stable healthcare delivery system.
Yeah, and I don't know if Ashley or Dr. Thorworth have anything else to add, but obviously this is an issue that you gave us the background, but it's not going away. I mean, this is something that's going to be hard for us to probably achieve long-term reform in the immediate future. And so we're going to have to keep cranking at this over and over again. Dr. Thorworth, I don't know if you have an extra thought or two that you'd like to add.
Yeah, I was just going to add, again, we talked about the back of the envelope calculation on the MPPR. We've also done similar assessment on the mitigation of the cuts that Rebecca just described, and it comes out to about $1.6 billion with a B dollars of reclaimed reimbursement for radiologists. And if you can sort of divide that out, it comes to about $46,000 per radiologist. And that's not forever, as has been pointed out, but that was certainly a major, major success in cutting back. And then, Ted, if I could just say for a moment, I know we're nearing the end, but I just wanted to get three common themes across all of what we've talked about here. One is that it really requires persistence and the development of relationships with people in Congress, relationships with other specialty societies that allow us to get these things accomplished. The second is the value of research and data, because if we go forward and just ask for something but don't have the data to support it, and a lot of the work that's been done through our Nieman Health Policy Institute has really aided us in getting these things done that have been described. And then finally, that advocacy goes beyond legislation. Everybody thinks of advocacy about going to Congress or state legislative bodies. But honestly, we've talked about legal advocacy. We've talked about advocacy with the regulatory bodies like CMS. So I just want to make sure those three common themes are available to our listeners.
And I think those are all really good points. And we're focusing on federal. It's not even talking about all the state stuff that, you know, the college works on in the government relations office. And that in and of itself could be a 3, 5, 10 part series, probably, too. I think you make a really good point, Dr. Thorworth, as far as the relationships. I mean, certainly that's kind of how we live in our department as far as relationships with staff, relationships with members of Congress themselves. And I think also to your point that Rebecca had also mentioned was with the other physician specialty groups. I mean, it's, you know, DC is kind of a funny place because you can go to a fundraising breakfast and you hear one group talk about an issue that, you know, we may have a big problem with. And then we may have a conference call with them later that same day where we're trying to come together and collaborate on a completely different issue. And so you just really can't burn bridges in DC. Those relationships are huge. And I think the last thing that kind of really sticks with me with all these things is that, you know, if you're a sports guy, I'm a sports guy, you say like, you know, people watch for offense, but defense wins championships. And a lot of times, you know, it's like, okay, well, to Rebecca's point, okay, now it's only a 3% cut instead of a 10% cut. But yeah, a 3% cut still stinks. But and a lot of factors go into that well beyond our control. But that 7% differential is significant to the point that you made, Dr. Thorworth. And so a lot of times we're fighting back. We're trying to stop the tidal wave as opposed to something that we can actually get done that's a little bit more on the offensive perspective. But all these things, you know, obviously have major impact on not just our members, the radiologists, but also the patients that they're taking care of. And so I don't know if anyone wants to have any other closing thoughts, but I think that was a really good quick summary of some pretty complicated, nuanced issues that have been around for a long period of time, and some of which are probably going to continue to remain pretty visible for us. Does anyone have any other thing to wrap up with? Or I appreciate you guys. You guys are great to work with, and I hope that I feel that, and I hope that our members appreciate what we do in DC. And I think more than anything else that they feel like we have best of intentions. We're working on their behalf. And, you know, that's our primary focus is doing what we can to make their job easier so they can do their job and not have to worry about all these things. So hopefully that's the case. Well, with that said, thank you all for your time and for your knowledge. And we will continue to keep fighting these fights. And hopefully we will continue to have some success. So thank you.
Thank you, Ted.